Zechariah 3 and the Day of Atonement. Purpose and methodology. While commentators have previously recognized that the removal of iniquity, should be avon, in Zechariah 3, 4, and 9 alludes to the Day of Atonement, this study will explore broader verbal and thematic connections between Zechariah 3 and the Day of Atonement rituals of Leviticus 16 and sketch the implications for the Christian theology of the Atonement. In considering the possibility that Zechariah 3 is informed by the Day of Atonement, it is important to note that Zechariah is a text that requires itself to be read in the context of its intertext, which is a fancy way of saying you have to compare Scripture with Scripture in order to get what Zechariah is trying to say. This study will attempt to establish that Zechariah 3 specifically references Leviticus 16 by examining three key words both texts have in common. It will also demonstrate how other intertextual references in Zechariah 3 contribute to thematic references to the Day of Atonement. So our key words. Zechariah 3 is one of three hinge visions that form the macro structure of Zechariah. It is in the middle of the night visions and unique among them because it involves not symbols but historical persons, and because the prophet plays an active role in forwarding the dramatic action. Of particular interest for this study are three key words that indicate the relationships between the persons in this vision. The first is before. The first character Zechariah sees in this vision is Joshua the high priest standing before the messenger of the Lord. The word before hints that Joshua has a cultic relationship to the messenger, because when before describes the spatial relationships of priests in the Old Testament, it most often refers to cultic activity performed, quote, before the Lord, or less frequently before the priest. Furthermore, Joshua is a high priest, and in the Old Testament, the high priest is said to perform cultic activity before someone on only two occasions. One, when he sprinkled the blood of an offering for his own sin before the Lord toward the front of the veil canopy of the sanctuary, and two, when he went inside the veil to perform the Day of Atonement rituals. With this cultic context of the scene established, it would seem that of the two possible rituals Joshua could be performing, Zechariah is most likely referencing the Day of Atonement, because Joshua appears to be in the same location as the Lord. Moreover, if that is the case, it raises the question of why Zechariah describes Joshua as standing before the messenger of the Lord and not as standing before the Lord himself in the most holy place. On the other hand, Joshua's cultic position before the messenger of the Lord may imply that the messenger of the Lord is, in fact, the Lord himself. So now we'll discuss the messenger of the Lord. It is not difficult to propose that in the Old Testament, the presence of the messenger of the Lord is interchangeable with the presence of the Lord himself. The challenge is to determine exactly when this interchangeable presence is present. A major indication that the messenger of the Lord represents the actual presence of the Lord is interchangeable speech or action in the narrative, where at one moment the messenger of the Lord is speaking or taking action, and the next the Lord has picked up the speech or taken action where the messenger left off. Other indications of when the messenger of the Lord acts or makes promises in ways that assume the Lord's authority, or when the messenger of the Lord is assumed to be the Lord by those with whom he interacts. In Zechariah 3:14, there is narrative interchangeability between the messenger of the Lord and the Lord. The messenger of the Lord also has the authority of the Lord as the central figure in the heavenly council. And as noted, Joshua's position before him indicates that Joshua is relating to the messenger of the Lord as if he were the Lord. Thus, the manner in which Zechariah 3 presents the messenger of the Lord strongly suggests an allusion to the Old Testament theme of interchangeability between the presence of the messenger of the Lord and the Lord himself. But the question remains, if in the vision Joshua is performing the Day of Atonement rituals in the sanctuary, why does Zechariah see him before the messenger of the Lord and not the Lord, since the messenger of the Lord never appears in the sanctuary in the Old Testament? One common factor when the Lord appears to humans as the messenger of the Lord is a situation where his unmediated presence would have been destructive due to lack of cultic propriety. And these are precisely the conditions present in Zechariah 3, where Joshua stands in the presence of divinity wearing filthy clothes. So now we'll discuss the clothes of Joshua. In 3:2, the Lord rebukes Satan before Satan has a chance to offer his accusation. In 3:3, we learn why Satan has no need to speak. It is the state of Joshua's clothes that does the accusing for Satan. And conversely, there is nothing Joshua can say in his own defense. The clothes richly bestowed on the high priest at his investiture and donned yearly for the Day of Atonement enabled him and all Israel synecdochally through him to relate properly to the Lord through the cultic ritual. Synecdochally means apart for the whole, apart standing in place of the whole. That the high priest was to be washed with water before donning the clothes symbolizes the physically clean state in which he was to perform the cultic rituals. In total contrast, Joshua's clothes are filthy, which the word means covered in excrement or vomit. Because Zechariah references other Old Testament texts by words with semantic overlap, the filth can refer to the dung of the animal sacrificed during the investiture and Day of Atonement rituals, which was burned outside the camp along with the rest of the offal. Sacrifices where dung was burned outside the camp ritually unloaded an extreme amount of uncleanness outside the camp. But in the vision of Zechariah 3, the high priest is covered in the very uncleanness his cultic rituals are meant to dispose of. At this point, I go on to discuss whether this is an atonement or an investiture scene, because most commentators say this is investiture. I'm going to summarize here. They call this an investiture scene. I take issue with that and call it an atonement scene, because everything that this vision has relating to the investiture can also relate to the Day of Atonement. And in fact, the Day of Atonement was a yearly renewal of the investiture. But the things that are unique to the investiture ritual are not mentioned in this chapter. However, things unique to the Day of Atonement are. And therefore, I conclude this is actually talking about the Day of Atonement. So that's a summary of the next section. So let's skip over that. To the conclusion there on page 11. It should be page 11 in yours, is it not? Maybe I have different pagination. Okay, well, go to the conclusion then if you will. Therefore, Zechariah 3, 1 through 5 is not portraying an investiture and a Day of Atonement ritual, because all its references to the investiture ritual, the changing clothes, and even the important turbit references may equally be references to the Day of Atonement preparation ritual. On the other hand, the reference to the priest before the Lord is connected to the Day of Atonement. And therefore, while Zechariah 3:1-5 may allude to the investiture ritual, the shocking picture the vision of Zechariah 3 paints is in fact that of the high priest standing before the Lord on the Day of Atonement in filthy clothes. It may be possible to conclude that this study has already established that Zechariah 3 references Leviticus 16 before addressing the third and most important keyword for establishing such a link. However, important questions still remain. How can the Lord tolerate such extreme impurity in his divine presence? And how will he resolve the situation? Now we'll discuss iniquity. The messenger's response to the untenable situation is to forgive Joshua's iniquity by removing his filthy clothes, thereby establishing a correct relationship between them. At this point, the vision of Zechariah 3 refers explicitly to the Day of Atonement, which was the only occasion in the Old Testament when iniquity was not simply expiated, but removed. This action, as interpreted by the messenger, pointed forward to an eschatological Day of Atonement when the Lord would remove the iniquity of this land in a single day. According to Gain, in Leviticus 1 through 16, iniquity is, quote, culpability, that is, liability to punishment, that arises from an act of expiable sin. Or, as the BDB puts it, avon is iniquity to be punished by judges. Liability to punishment implies a judgment to decide whether or not one will be punished. This legal dimension of the removal of iniquity on the Day of Atonement explains why Joshua, before the messenger, is not only in the posture of cultic ritual, but also in the posture of standing in a royal court, in this case, the Lord's heavenly council, about to be judged. Satan and the heavenly council. The vision of Zechariah 3 conforms to the conventions of the Old Testament heavenly council type scene. But Zechariah 3 specifically references the heavenly council scenes of Job 1 through 2 because unique to these instances, Satan is present in the heavenly council. And God rebuts, in Zechariah 3, even preempts his accusations. Zechariah 3 is a mirror image of Job 1 through 2. Job is upright, yet punished, while Joshua is culpable, yet acquitted. In both cases, God as judge acts in the ultimate, though in Job's case not immediate, good of the human in question. Yet in doing so, appears to flout his own requirement that judges, quote, exonerate the innocent, but condemn the guilty, from Deuteronomy 25:2. In Job, God does this to defend his honor before the heavenly council in the face of Satan's questions regarding his distribution of blessings and punishments. In Zechariah 3, Satan remains silent because his unspoken questions, in conjunction with his unspoken accusations, ask themselves. And there I invite you to the footnote 41, where I quote a commentator on the subject. He says, "How can a man who ought to be condemned be summarily acquitted and appointed to high office? Either sheer arbitrariness or wanton partiality is operating here." That silent question asks itself is what I'm arguing. By the presence of Satan in the heavenly council, Zechariah 3 connects the atonement theme of Leviticus 16 to the great controversy theme of Job 1 through 2. In Zechariah 3, God's removal of iniquity and restoration of his people has ramifications for his reputation, calling into question his suitability as heavenly judge. The question Zechariah 3 adds to the great controversy theme of Job 1 through 2 is whether it is possible for God to be both merciful and just. And the promise it adds to the atonement theme of Leviticus 16 is that of a final and total removal of iniquity. God's answer to Satan's silent insinuations is the promise of an eschatological day of atonement, which in connection with the messianic activity of the branch will accomplish a swift and total removal of iniquity that will bring about the new idyllic age. Why would God wait for a future day of atonement to answer these questions? The only difference between the promised day of atonement and those that precede it is the branch, who has not yet come, and therefore seems to be what enables the ultimate removal of iniquity. Because the Day of Atonement was Israel's yearly judgment day, this promise of an eschatological Day of Atonement is the same as a promise of an eschatological Day of Judgment. The removal of Joshua's iniquity is a sign act of what this promised eschatological Day of Atonement judgment would look like. During this eschatological Day of Atonement judgment, God will have an opportunity to answer, presumably on the basis of what the branch has done, any question the heavenly council and Satan may have regarding whether God is just in removing iniquity from his people. Therefore, the eschatological Day of Atonement judgment is a historical process, beginning with the messianic activity of the branch, and ending on the day all iniquity is removed, by which God will exonerate and consummate the removal of his people's iniquity. Until then, iniquity is removed only on the basis of the ultimate removal that is to come. This study has by now demonstrated from three key words, before, close, and iniquity, that the vision of Zechariah 3 specifically references the Day of Atonement ritual of Leviticus 16. Furthermore, we have seen how important intertextual references in Zechariah 3 to the identity of the messenger of the Lord, the removal of moral filth, the renewal of the priesthood and sanctuary, the heavenly council type scene, and the presence of Satan develop great controversy themes present within Leviticus 16 and 23 verses 27 to 32. What remains is for this study to briefly sketch the implications of this understanding of Zechariah 3 for the Christian doctrine of the atonement. And here we go into a section with much fewer footnotes because I am briefly sketching possibilities, not working anything terribly systematic out. In the previous sections, we established, among other things, that Zechariah 3 is symbolically promising an eschatological Day of Atonement. Based on this premise, along with the rest of this study, I propose three theological implications for the Christian doctrine of the atonement. One, the atonement has a cosmic scope. And two, only God can make atonement, but nevertheless, three, atonement is contingent on human cooperation. The atonement in Zechariah 3 is cosmic because it is larger than any single person, location, or event. This atonement is not primarily concerned with the atonement of Joshua, Zechariah, or any other individual, but with Jerusalem, whom God has chosen, with the priests, whom Joshua represents, and with the land from which God will remove iniquity. Its spatial scope is broader than any single location, answering the questions of beings in heaven and implying a restoration of all creation in a single day at the completion of the process. Temporally, Zechariah 3's eschatological day of atonement is a process, beginning with the messianic branch and ending on the single day at the end of this age. There is no direct mention of the sacrificial event because Zechariah 3 deals with questions regarding the fairness of atonement that prior sacrifice has evidently not answered. In Zechariah 3, the sufficiency of the sacrifice is not the issue, but rather the purity of the priest. The Levitical high priest was divinely appointed to represent his people before God in order to accomplish atonement. But in Zechariah 3, it is absolutely impossible for Joshua to make atonement. The vision of Zechariah 3 exposes the inadequacies of a system that depended on fallible humans to accomplish atonement at a limited scale. The eschatological atonement of Zechariah 3 is not based on the cultic rituals of the human high priest, but rather on the eschatological messianic activity of the branch, who allows for God to be both, quote, just and the justifier of the ones who lives because of Jesus' faithfulness, Romans 3:26. From this perspective, the reconciliation accomplished through the eschatological Day of Atonement judgment is a pure act of grace. According to Zechariah 3, the only hope of God's people in this judgment is the choice of God to save them. And if that is the case, God's people should take comfort in the fact that our judge is unreservedly biased in our favor, because he is the one that immediately acquitted Joshua, the high priest who brought disgusting filth into the most holy place. On the flip side, according to Zechariah 3:7, the benefits of atonement are conditional upon individual acceptance of God's will and destiny for one's life. Although the symbolic Joshua of the vision could not refuse the clean clothes, the historical Joshua and the priests were free to reject the atonement offered by making choices inconsistent with it. The eschatological atonement of Zechariah 3 may be cosmic in scope, accomplished solely by God and effective for all God's people, but that does not imply that the God of Zechariah 3 compels individuals to be reconciled against their will. Zechariah 3:7 teaches that although humans cannot make atonement, in order to be reconciled, God's people must accept reconciliation by making obedient choices that demonstrate trust in God. In the eschatological Day of Atonement judgment, as with Israel on the Day of Atonement, God's people must choose to participate in the process in order to receive its benefits. Proposals. I propose at least two theological themes in Zechariah 3 could positively impact or inform the Christian doctrine of the atonement. First, the cosmic scope of the eschatological Day of Atonement judgment can protect Christians from an isolated and self-centered understanding of final judgment, while at the same time answering the question of why, given God's omniscience, final judgment is even necessary by pointing out the role of angelic beings in this judgment. Secondly, stating that while only God can make atonement, human response is necessary for us to receive the benefit thereof, attempts to express the finely balanced relation of grace to law in the process of atonement judgment that is vividly portrayed in the vision of Zechariah 3. The soteriology of this symbolic story has the capacity to help both the sensitive and the much needed, to help both the sensitive and the hard-hearted find much-needed assurance of salvation, and the hard-hearted make a full commitment to God. Sorry, I messed that last sentence up, but that will be the end of my paper. Thank you very much.